Welcome to the first episode of the All Else Equal Book Club on Angridomics by Eric Lonergan and Mark Blythe. We're going to structure the discussion on the book so that you'll be able to follow along even if you haven't read the book. That being said, you'll probably get more out of the discussion if you've read the book first. Go read the book. Like most things, the more you put into it, the more you'll get out of it. We'll leave it to you, the listener, to best decide what your marginal productivities are.
It's good. We're bringing in econ jargon at the very beginning. All right, so the book is centered around five dialogues. Today, we're going to focus on the first two dialogues, and we'll leave dialogues 3, 4, and 5 for separate episodes that we're going to release soon. We've also got a special guest for the series. So John Ivory Winston III has generously agreed to join us from sunny Arizona for the next few episodes. John's an IT specialist by trade, and Jason and I always enjoy our conversations with him. His primary academic interests are related to philosophy, but more importantly, for the purpose of the next few podcasts, John has one of the best bullshit detectors of anyone we know. So having him on is going to help us sift through the BS in the book and also serve as a check on me and Jason's bullshit.
Yeah, it's always helpful. Hey, John, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking some Pendleton whiskey.
That's great. Forrest, what do you got?
I have Beck's non-alcoholic beer, which I'm a little bit ashamed to admit on air.
I'll edit that out. No, I'm not gonna. So I've got a nice, I got a nice toasty Pinot Noir going.
All right. So with that, let's get started with the discussion of Angridomics. So I think the first thing we should do is just I'll provide like a brief overview of kind of the point of the book and some of the structure. And then we'll kind of get to the heart of the first two dialogues. We'll kind of go through it somewhat start to finish and kind of point out kind of key quotes and things that we agree with, things we don't agree with, and kind of more importantly, I guess, things that we disagree with each other about. So the start of the book, the first dialogue, and actually all the book is going to focus on three different types of anger. So this is Angrynomics. And we want to think about these different types of anger, and the authors are going to make a this claim that there's been a rise in particular types of these angers. So they divide the anger into public and private, and the discussion of this is kind of confusing sometimes. So the public anger is divided into what they describe as tribal and moral. And so when we talk about the end of the first dialogue in particular, we'll kind of get to their, they make some normative claims about like which is good and which is bad, and we'll kind of think about whether we agree with that and like how you would identify that. So this is public anger, which is related to kind of tribalism. And then there is this private anger, which is more kind of idiosyncratic due to uncertainty to the individual. So these first two dialogues are going to focus on public anger. And then it's going to be broken down into moral outrage and tribal rage. And then we're going to think about kind of the economic history of the 1900s, the early 2000s, and kind of these ebbs and flows of these different types of anger. I think the best place to start is with, you know, we're talking about sort of tribalism and things like that. We just start with this idea of tribal identity. So on page 20 and page 21, there's a couple of nice quotes. On page 20, at the very bottom, starting with, now think about tribal identity. So now think about tribal identity more broadly. What is the social function of the tribe? It's very simple. Humans are much more successful operating in groups, and being part of a group increases your odds of survival. But in a world of limited resources, you need to decide who is in the group and who is not. We can't survive on our own, but we can't include everyone if resources are scarce. Our hardwiring to form groups is so profound that we will form tribes based on trivial differences. Indeed, perhaps we always form them based on trivial differences. And then later down on page 21, there's going to be one more kind of short snippet. Now, not all groups should be seen as tribal. Tribal identity is a particularly deep felt and existential form of group identity, which needs periodic enforcement and regulation in the same way that social norms do. Most of the time, we are not focused on our tribal identity. We get on with our lives. In peaceful, prosperous times, tribal identity takes a back seat. But if we think we are threatened, if we think resources are becoming scarce, or if we are stressed, the minority of angry fans serves a function. And so they talk about how these sort of angry sports fans are serving as kind of checks on making sure that the members of the tribe are actually kind of behaving as they should. So for the purposes of the book, let's start the conversation. Kind of what do we see as kind of like the relevant tribes both kind of mention the book or just kind of as we sort of think about what's going on currently.
Yeah, I think it's hard for me not to think of us breaking ourselves into tribes politically, right? I mean, that over the last couple of years, maybe, I mean, more intensely in the last 2 years, but over the last 4 years, it feels like people are, you know, are touching on that definition of kind of tribalism and for some reason feel stressed, right? And they're trying to get into a group of like-minded individuals to try and, you know, protect themselves.
Yeah, just as a kind of a note for the listener. So this is January 18th. I think this is about a week and a half after the failed coup attempt slash, I don't know, parlor profile picture taking event that happened at the Capitol building. So like, it's kind of easy to think about like that as being a tribe, right? So like,
yeah.
Sort of like populism, sure. Nationalism movement. And that's what the authors are going to identify as, like, they're going to kind of keep coming back to this idea of nationalism and things like that.
I mean, do you agree with that, Forrest? John, do you think like that's been the driving tribe, you know, over the last couple of years?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely have seen it. I feel like I saw it starting to manifest itself under like the Obama administration. And it was like, I feel like it was really quiet. And then as soon as kind of Trump came out and was kind of who he was, and after, I mean, even when he was in like the candidacy stage, running against other Republicans, it was still like pretty divided. But I feel like as soon as he won like the Republican candidacy, everyone, I feel like that tribe just got really strong and really loud really quickly.
Yeah, so I'm from South Carolina, and Lindsey Graham is one of the senators there. And like watching Lindsey Graham go from like being very complimentary of Joe Biden to like the evolution to now, definitely kind of says something about like how Trump has like been able to form and coalesce that tribe. I do want to kind of mention that in this book, they're very kind of critical of Trump and different aspects of nationalism, as they should be. But like, if you think about the left too, kind of coming back to what Jason said about like different political parties, like another tribe that is not really mentioned explicitly in the book is like kind of like the progressive left.
Yeah, so right.
If you think about like, I don't know, I'm just
Bernie Sanders, AOC.
Yeah, Warren, right. And like, you know, I'm just sort of thinking about my dad kind of like getting a scowl on his face, kind of talking about Nancy and Chuck. And like, so I mean, like, so there are different tribal parties. Like these, the two authors, Eric and Mark, are like both, you know, they temper their statements. They're not making kind of anything that's like too crazy progressive. I mean, like, I guess maybe we'll kind of keep coming back to that. But like, they're definitely progressive economists. Okay, so like, they're definitely left of center, and we just want to keep that in mind as we keep going through the book.
I think one of the things that they, you know, touched on, but I wish they kind of emphasized a little bit more, was the impact social media has on forming these tribes, right? And how that can like fuel anger. And it just felt, you know, especially in, not to get too far ahead, but in the second dialogue, it just felt like, you know, there is this lingering question that they had, was like this chicken or the egg, like how does this anger begin to manifest? And, you know, I one of the things that I thought of right away was like, well, it was always there, right? The anger's just always been there. It's nothing that created the anger. It's just, it's always been there. And now because of social media and because politicians are becoming very savvy with social media, they're able to group together and create these tribes. Whereas before, people were just kind of scattered around and they didn't have a way to kind of develop this tribe. And so they were kind of like tangentially attached to some aspect of some tribe, but maybe not fully invested. And, but now they can, right? It's just everyone thinks the same thing because they can find each other across the country, across the world. And I just
learned how to make memes.
Yeah, that's
right.
There's all these meme groups. But, you know, they don't really mention kind of social media as echo chambers and like that idea explicitly. They do talk about the competition in media in sort of a strange way.
Yeah, right.
In the first dialogue. So there's a quote I highlighted on page 28 that I did want to kind of come to. So the quote's on page 27. So at the top of 27, Mark says, so this is an important point. Newspapers used to operate as semi-monopolies with captive readerships. Yes, their proprietors had political goals and they could influence and periodically determine elections, but they never had to fight for eyeballs. Even with the emergence of stable islands of readers built around paywalls, the shift in technology and emergence of social media has brutally challenged these old media monopolies and confronted them with the reality of competition. The Sun newspaper in the UK used to sell over 3 million copies a day and determine elections. Now it's down to 1 million a day, while Facebook matters much more. So given this, what better way to motivate a readership than with stories of fear, terror, and foreigners overrunning your lands? When we consider the set of forces at work, it becomes clear why tribal anger has become an exploitable resource of segments of the political class. Indeed, recent research shows how even mainstream centrist politicians have adopted the language of populist outrage. It works to win, but when we think about the consequences and risk they're running with, that this is paramount that we combat it. What do you guys think about that? Like, so the idea that like an increase in competition between kind of more traditional media sources and social media, they're kind of focusing on like how has traditional media changed its content?
I can definitely see how, I mean, I don't remember what CNN was posting or, you know,
posting, yeah, or
what they were doing 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
But there definitely is so much fear mongering, but I don't think that necessarily happens more than even like those outside of the lamestream media. Like a lot of really small independent media stations, I feel like are often just as bad, if what not way worse, because they don't have as much fact checking and stuff like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, so I actually really disagree with this statement, because I think that even though that there's more competition, like it basically creates more moats. So in the sense that like, if you're a, what is it? OAN? Is that kind of a right leaning news network?
When Trump had his Twitter, he was mentioning that Fox was too left to center for him.
Yeah, right.
So I'm guessing that it's pretty conservative.
Right. So like you have to, so they've have carved out a very specific niche, and mm-hmm. And so they've created kind of their own monopoly there. Right. And so it's going to be hard for CNN to compete with a news organization like that. It's going to be hard for the Wall Street Journal to kind of compete. And that's what I mean by moat. Right. So I actually think there's much less competition because individuals are seeking out new sources to kind of create this self-referential cycle of belief. And so we get this kind of maybe even, I don't know what the right term is, but this kind of consolidated monopoly around one or two specific ideas. And that's where people get their information from, right? So if I'm watching OAN, I am not watching CNN. I'm not reading Wall Street Journal, not reading New York Times. And so, and I think that that's true even on the left side, right? And so I think people are just kind of more, they just get embedded into a media source.
What would you say about, I mean, growing media organizations like Vox that are nonpartisan, explanatory? Like, how would you explain the success of companies like that in the wake of OAN and MSNBC and Breitbart?
Even when Vox says that like they're not nonpartisan, like Matt Iglesias recently left Vox because like Vox had become too far on the left for him.
Yeah, so,
like,
right.
Far on the left for Matt Iglesias, than like, I don't know. Like, I think you're somewhat partisan. So I you hear that about, like, different sources will say they're nonpartisan, but, like, I don't know, like, everybody kind of has an axe to grind, and every organization has, like, a mission, right? There's some sort of mission statement for all these. And, like, you can't kind of get around. You have to have some sort of goals. You have to have some sort of mission. And, like, that is going to at least be correlated with different aspects of different parties, right? These different political coalitions and, like, what they stand for. So, I don't know. It kind of back to Jason's point, like, where we have less competition. The thing that seems to be driving this is, it's like access, right? It's like it's like the internet, and now, like, I have access to OAN if I really want to, like, get together with my buddies and, like, storm the Capitol or whatever it is. And as an economist, you know, it just, like, it rubs me the wrong way. I just have, like, the hair on the back of my neck is, like, standing up, where it's like increases in competition is leading to something bad. It's like, I don't know, like, that doesn't seem quite right.
Yeah, right. No, you're right, though. Right. It seems counterintuitive that these things are happening. But I mean, I'm sure that as economists, we could argue for everyone, maximizing your individual utility makes society better off. Right. In some aspects, because
there's like a market failure, right? There's some sort of market failure where there's, like, some sort of, you know, in the words of economics, it's like, this increased access leads to us, like, by maximizing our utility or whatever, by, like, you know, it's like doing whatever we want to. Like, if I really, like, you know, if whatever, you know, CNN really resonates with me, all right, and then it's like, and I get together with a bunch of like-minded people, there's got to be some argument. There's, like, a negative externality of, like, if the three of us, you know, if we didn't kind of have access to our own sort of thoughts and stuff like that, and we weren't able to, like, get on message boards and things like that, like, we wouldn't organize and do dumb politically motivated stuff. But, you know, this increased access is allowing us to, like, get together and serve as, like, some sort of, like, echo chamber with each other.
Yeah, I mean, you guys can fact check me out there, but I just saw a stat today, something like misinformation is down 73%. Over
that sounds kind like of, fake news. That's gotta be
over the internet as soon as Trump's Twitter was blocked or dropped, whatever.
That's real.
How did they measure that? Like, this was
just the quantity of you know, untruthful stories kind of being on perpetuated. I don't know if it was over the internet or on Twitter or what, but.
Okay.
Yeah, so
just as a kind of a note of support for their statement about these news sources being polarized, there's a paper by Genzkow and Shapiro. I think it's from the early 2010s, where they're looking at kind of like Fox, CNN, and looking at how they sort of changed over time. We'll put a link up in the podcast description, but, like, the stylized result that I remember is that, like, yeah, indeed, like, that's what you see, is that, you know, these news organizations over time have become more and more polarized. We've been talking a lot about tribalism. Maybe we should take a step back and just kind of talk about, like, they have a nice quote on 23 on exactly what they mean by these two different types of public anger. So let's just make sure we're still on the same page about this, like, moral outrage versus, like, tribal rage. So on page 22, they have this nice description of kind of what's the difference between moral outrage and this tribal rage. So top of 22, Mark says, that all makes sense. So we have two types of public anger. We have moral outrage, a legitimate response to being ignored, a vocalizing of wrongdoing, and a call for redress and action. That is the anger we should be listening to and responding to. On the other side, we have anger as tribal energy that can be cynically harnessed and weaponized by opportunists. But in viewing both of these forms of anger as emotions that function to solve a collective action problem to help us survive collectively, you risk making tribal anger seem benign. Well, is it? And so what do you think? I mean, like, do we think of tribal anger as benign?
No, I mean, no, right? I guess I don't know what the flow is, right? What is the Granger causality there? So is, like, tribal anger leading into moral outrage, and is, like, the catalyst for that is some opportunist, right? Because if you just have tribal anger and no one kind of rallies everyone around a common goal, well, then I guess tribal anger is benign. But if there's a catalyst that creates the then the moral outrage, well, then it's not benign, right?
Right. How does a hurricane start?
Yeah,
and a lot of different factors.
This is a criticism I have with the book, is like they don't really make a sort of a distinction between like what is moral outrage versus like what is tribal anger, except by kind of saying like, well, moral outrage are like legitimate claims, and tribalism is like in some sense like this anger that's irrational, that's like being used by politicians. And so I agree with you both that like it's not clear kind of like, first of all, what the dividing line is, but like what is causing what, okay? So like if I am part of one of these tribes and I'm, you know, feel disenfranchised or whatever, you know, politicians can harness that, and you might call that tribal rage if I go to rallies or I protest or counter protest or whatever. But it could be from some sort of like legitimate complaint. So I might be mad about, you know, stagnant wages. I might be mad about like not feeling like I have a political voice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not clear to me, like, if I'm upset about that, like, what is that? How should I think about that as being this moral outrage versus tribal rage? Is it only like, is it tribal rage only when like I'm doing something that like is like
self-preservation?
No, but they talk about this as like solving a collective action problem, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like we're part of some group that like we are suffering from something, and like collectively we want to get together and like have our political voice heard and like try and change some policy, right?
So we know. But that, I thought that's moral outrage, right? By the way they define it.
Well, yeah, I think that's one kind of criticism that
yeah, no, I agree with your criticism.
Really kind of clear,
right? To me. Like, it isn't clear to me. But and so I kind of read it as like, I mean, the way that they explained it, I think in the book was through some examples, and they used the financial crisis and kind of things happening through the financial crisis, especially in Iceland, and how people became morally outraged. Right, it was a reaction to something that had happened, and it wasn't like this tribal anger that instigated the moral outrage. It was an action by someone else that kind of rallied people around for a change. And so that's the way that I kind of envision the difference between the two, right? Is that something happens, I don't agree with it, but my voice isn't heard. And so that now I come, you know, I get more mad and I find a group of people that have the same anger, and we get together, and our tribal rage leads into moral outrage again.
And so is the collective action problem like, so let's stick with that example, the financial crisis. So it's like, you know, we see these policies that are being implemented to like, quote unquote, bail out the big banks, right? So like to prevent financial catastrophe, mm-hmm. you know, the government props up the banks. And then so like, you know, Swedish or the Icelandic forest is like ticked off because like he's working two jobs, and you know, and then the government's kind of telling me like, well, we can't like increase unemployment benefits, or we can't improve the social safety net because we can't prove this. So like we all get together and we say like, look, we have some sort of like virtuous outrage, this moral outrage about like it's not fair, and like, you know, that there's something inefficient in some sense, that we, at least that's what we believe, going on, that can then be harnessed as like this tribal rage by politicians. And maybe the tribal rage would be like us like acting on it in like some way, like storming a Capitol building or something like that.
Yeah, right. No, I think that's exactly it. I don't know. John, were you, how old were you during the, after the financial crisis? Do you remember it? Like, is that something that you remember?
I definitely do. I would have been like 12.
Been 12.
In 2007.
So is that something that you like, you noticed? Like, did you, I don't know if you can remember that far back, but is that something that you remember happening?
It was definitely pretty unclear to me at that time. I just remember there being a lot of stress and anxiety, at least like in my own home. With like uncertainty with my dad's job, you know, uncertainty on how the bills will be paid. But I mean, as like a middle schooler,
yeah, right.
I didn't know that was abnormal or what exactly how that played out in like a bigger, you know, on the bigger field.
So looking back, now like, you know, we're 10 years plus 11 years, you know, after recovery now, basically. I mean, looking back, do you have a different sense of kind of our approach to things, right? So the both the fiscal and monetary approach to solving the financial crisis, right? Do you have my question is like, do you have a lagging tribal rage or moral outrage?
Yeah, deep down inside.
I was waiting until Jason triggered him, and now I'm to like go out and like who knows what he's gonna do tonight. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I'm opportunist.
Now it's on the surface. I definitely I have to admit I don't look at least for most of my adult life I've not looked at political issues and economic issues from like a fiscal spending standpoint. It definitely is way easier to tap into like that tribal anger on both sides. I feel like I'm constantly being tossed back and forth between left progressivist tribal anger and, you know, right, you know, religious and, you know, more conservative tribal anger, just being influenced by a lot of different sides. So it's just definitely way easier to be influenced by that for me than by a couple of, you know, professors who are economists and business majors.
Wait, you know, one thing you just mentioned, let me say two things. One thing you just mentioned was like, you mentioned religion and like, we haven't mentioned religion at all yet. And like, in terms of right. About tribalism, like that's a huge one. The second thing is just like as a note, John has like declared that he is going to out, Jason and I as being frauds by the end of these four episodes. So Jason and I are walking very carefully.
Yeah, I welcome the attempt.
Yeah, I can see you guys both sweating.
Yep. So you know, it's really funny. I you know, they don't mention religion at all. And we had a podcast earlier in the year, John. I don't know if you listened to it. That basically just talked about That talked just specifically about how religion is basically intertwined now with the, you know, the right, and how people are kind of using, you know, politicians. This is a perfect example of like politicians being the catalyst for tribal rage. I thought, as soon as I read this, I thought of our podcast, where they're basically piggybacking on these few important religious points to make them the dominant, you know, political platform. And that kind of rallies that base for them in a way that we really haven't seen, you know, in, you know, since it started basically back in 2004-ish, right around their time when Bush started to really use the religious right. So I wish the book, and maybe they will, you know, but in the first two dialogues, I wish they discussed a little bit more about the religious impact on, especially the right and how that can create tribalism.
But gosh, I mean, look what all these, you know, evangelical Christians have done in terms of supporting Trump, you know, and saying like, in sort of like, say like, look, you know, maybe his actions aren't exactly in line with our values, but you know, got what, two people on the Supreme Court, three people?
Yeah.
Right.
And so, I mean, and so now like, well, you know, we're willing to kind of take that deal if it's going to lead to, you know, ultimately going to lead to kind of a society that puts more weight, or, you know, legislation's formed that is in line with more conservative, religious values.
Yeah. I didn't know if we would get a chance to even touch on that. Just because, I mean, it's Angrynomics, so it looks at it from more of a economic perspective, but like, I've definitely heard a lot of people say that there are, no matter like what Donald Trump says, as long as he backs, you know, like illegalizing abortion, that they constantly, you know, they will have his back. Right. And so that's really, it's from an economic perspective that, you know, might not be something worth talking about in a book, but it's definitely something that when you're on the ground level, that's has a really big impact on the like political landscape.
I agree, right? And I think in this book in particular, this would be the book where you'd want to talk about, right, these singular issues, right? It's no longer like these pluralism issues that are driving people's beliefs. It's these singular issues that are really forming these tribes. And it's just really interesting where these tribes are being formed. And then again, how the politicians, you know, this is how I just envision this process. And is that people have these underlying beliefs and they are then grouped together by through some common, you know, medium, whether it be church or social media. And then some opportunist creates, you know, a catalyst, a spark, something where now they feel like morally outraged, right? And this is exactly how I see these things happening. It's just there. It's just, you know, people just feel these things. We just have now the ability to come together easier.
Absolutely.
That's a good segue to the second dialogue where they're kind of talking about the history of, you know, they're going to slam the technocratic center that happened during the Great Moderation and kind of talk about, you know, why the financial crisis was a tipping point. Before, just to kind of wrap up this dialogue, I'm just going to read a quote from page 30, and it's actually page 30. So at the very end of page 30, this is Mark. Okay, let me summarize and set up where we are going next. We analyze anger in our politics, especially public anger. It's important to keep tribal anger and moral outrage distinct. The financial crisis, the brutal recession in its wake, the euro crisis, rising income and wealth inequality, and an abject failure of political representation are at the core of our problems. They are and should be objects of moral rebuke. But while these factors motivate anger and that anger finds its way into politics, this has to be separated from the energy of tribes and the cynical exploitation by politicians and the media of latent nationalistic identities to get elected and to sell copy. How they chose to fill the vacuum created by an anodyne identity-free political centrism. The former we can and should do something about, and the policies we shall discuss later are designed to do just that. The latter we should expose and disarm since they are more harmful than the grievances that they are a response to. Okay, so let's turn to the lessons we can learn from legitimate anger. And you know, as I'm reading this, this is kind of coming back to the criticisms we've been mentioning. I just don't really know who's the arbiter of like what is legitimate anger and what is not legitimate.
Yeah, no, I agree. No, right. I agree. Yeah.
Okay. And then finally, before we go to the second dialogue, there's a great book. I don't know if either of you read it. It's by Jonathan Haidt. He's a political scientist. It's called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Argue or Disagree About Politics in Religion. And like Haidt does a really nice job of kind of outlining why people on the left and the right are like not really arguing about the same thing when they argue. And like, it's kind of provides a motivation for like why reasonable people, because they disagree on these different dimensions of their values, get into like all, you know, as we all know, kind of what can be contentious debates about politics.
Hmm.
All right. Any final thoughts on dialogue one before we move to the second one?
No, let's go.
Sure.
All right. Okay. So, you know, when I was reading the second dialogue, I found it kind of confusing at first. I thought they were going to kind of talk about private anger now, but the focus of this is still going to be moral outrage.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels like at least in dialogue two, they begin to explore what could be driving at least some of the moral outrage, right? The decisions that people are making, right? And I appreciated as soon as we got into that, into some of like the basic fiscal policy decisions that both the United States and the EU made after the financial crisis, I started appreciating what they meant a little bit more by like people feeling disenfranchised and not having a voice because of the, you know, basically there's two different classes, right? There's the political class and then everyone else, and feels like the politicians in some regard are making rules that they don't have to play by. And so that it makes a lot of sense. So I liked when they began to explore that.
They do mention private anger very briefly at the top of 36. And I want to highlight this one to kind of make sure we're kind of on the same page. What's the difference between private anger and public moral outrage? because we're going to kind of come back to that when they talk about micro versus macro in future dialogues. But so let me just read the quote first on 36 at the top. Public expressions of moral outrage take a very specific form. Private anger is typically seen as a weakness, reflecting the fact that something is wrong within us. But public expressions of moral outrage are defended by justifying the anger itself. Typically, moral outrage appeals to unfairness, a failure to listen to those who are affected, and a failure to recognize the interest of those most affected. For example, expressions of anger against the imposition of austerity policies in Europe, as our parable highlights, follows this structure. The democratic process was frequently hijacked by technocrats, i.e. me and Jason, enforcing reforms when there was no economic logic to support austerity. This last part is very, very important in terms of looking at the viewpoint of the authors. The last sentence talking about these austerity reforms, which just kind of for the listener is kind of like, when you think about austerity, it's like cutting back on fiscal spending, increasing taxation. Why are you doing this? Well, you're trying to pay off debt, right? From a public standpoint. And like, there is an economic logic to support austerity. Okay. The authors are going to be very, very kind of casual in terms of their concern about rising levels of government debt. As someone who's personally not super concerned about rising levels of public debt, I am even appalled by like how little they are concerned about rising debt. What we're going to see is like, they're kind of in line with the modern monetary theory crowd in the sense, like they're going to make the distinction between why they're not the MMT crowd later on. But in terms of like concern about public debt, it just needs to be kind of, I want to put a pin in this, that like, as we go through the book, like the authors are not super concerned with rising levels of government debt. And like, we're going to have to kind of keep coming back to like, all right, let's pump the brakes a little bit, or at least think about why maybe we would want to pump the brakes.
I mean, it's, you know, to interject a little bit of econ here, right? I this is something that we're going to be start seeing right now. Kind of, you know, we're a year into virtually this pandemic, and we're going to see, you know, at the federal level, hopefully a Biden administration that continues to create relief and spending stimulus opportunities. But at the state and kind of county level, at the state and county level, I think we're going to see austere policies happening, right? Because they just don't have the ability to borrow and spend like the federal government does. And so you're going to see a lot of cuts across the board about education, K-12, higher education, transportation, right? It's just going to happen. And I think in the EU, I'm not an expert, but you know, because some of the countries are a little bit handcuffed in what they can, you know, what kind of monetary policy they can perform, they had to turn to austerity, right? And so to kind of back up Forrest's point, like sometimes it happens, right? I mean, it just happens. It's just something that's like your only choice sometimes.
Yeah, Germany and Greece are very different with different fiscal authorities, which ended up leading into problems. I did want to mention, to just kind of clarify Jason's point about state and local governments, and why maybe they're going to suffer more than that spending is going to suffer more than at the federal level, right? The federal level, like we can, you know, the U.S. Treasury can, in some sense, create money. And like, so with all this sort of this relief, these $600 checks or $1,200 checks or $2,000 checks, whatever it is, right? That's paid for by the federal government issuing debt. And that debt is like very, very tradable. Like that is a safe asset, as of now, at least. And, you know, if you're the state of Illinois or some other state or, you know, some big municipality, like you don't have that power to print whatever, and you don't have your own currency, right? You know, so the state of Arizona doesn't print whatever sunshine dollars or whatever they would be called.
Johnny dollars.
Okay, so are we okay moving forward?
Yeah, go listen to our podcast with Rudy Bachman if you want to learn more about fiscal kind of spending and austerity and MMT.
I love the plugs. It's great. All right, so the authors now are going to kind of walk us through quickly kind of different eras And they're going to use this as a way to kind of talk about why are we economically, why do we see growing discontent? Why do we see a rise in moral outrage? And so they break these eras up into kind of post-World War II as like an experiment that kind of ends with the stagflation of the 1970s, where we saw both like reductions in output, increased unemployment, and rising inflation. And so if you are the monetary authority, if you have rising inflation, you have increased unemployment, excuse me, it's not clear kind of what the right remedy is. You can engage in contractionary policy, which is going to kind of hurt employment more, but reduce inflation, or you can engage in expansionary policy, which is going to be good for employment, but also generate more inflation. Ultimately, what we saw in the late 70s, early 80s with the Volcker era was kind of very contractionary monetary policy that kind of reined in inflation, and we had this double dip recession in the early 80s as a result of that. Then led to like what we call the Great Moderation, and so this is like early 80s to the financial crisis, so to 08-09. And I love this quote they have on page 37, starting with this is the second paragraph on page 37 with Mark. We describe the era of neoliberalism as fostering a loss of political identity, creating a vacuum that tribal anger has filled. But an unintended consequence of the post-Cold War political convergence between parties in the 1990s and 2000s was the emergence of a lifeless and largely self-serving technocratic center, which caused large segments of the electorate to feel voiceless and unrepresented, which was steadily reflected in declining electoral turnouts. So a couple of things. First, this statement of lifeless and largely self-serving technocratic center, I absolutely love. Oh yeah. Like that's such a beautiful way to like describe like technocrats. And you know, I was listening to the news a couple of days ago, and Biden was gonna, I heard a clip, it was like Biden is promoting somebody, counselor of science, somebody to like a cabinet position. And like that's not actually the title, but it's like when you hear, you know, you hear this like rhetoric by Biden, which is now like, oh, everything is gonna be backed by science and stuff like that, and that actually makes me uneasy. That kind of reminds me of like exactly what the authors are going to pinpoint as like, yeah, technocrats like don't have a great track record despite how smart they think they are, which these authors are going to say like kind of culminated in the financial crisis. And so, what, you know, Jason, what do you think about like, you know, you were voting in the 90s, like, did you kind of feel like if you were voting for Bush versus Gore or Clinton versus Bush, the senior, like, did you feel like there was a big difference between those?
As someone who didn't live through that, I'd be really curious as to hear, like, what's the difference between Bush and Gore, especially, like, compared to, like, what was the difference between Obama and Romney or, like, people who I remember? How was that way different, if you remember?
Yeah, no. First, how old do you think I am?
Like, 47?
Yeah, so I'm about 117.
I thought you were, like, 42.
I was not voting in the 90s. I turned 18 in 2000. So
okay, but still.
So I mean,
first election.
Yeah, I don't even know if I anyways. All right. So I got to admit, I was an art student back in 2000. And so
no way.
Yeah, so I was not the I didn't have my pulse on kind of the national kind of political media, but I do, you know, thinking back and, you know, talking to some friends, I have a really good friend who voted for Bush in 2004, who has since voted Democrat, you know, religiously thereafter. You know, in conversations that we had, it was, you know, again, there was still pluralism in political platforms in the sense that candidates had to promote a variety of different policies that appealed to a whole spectrum of potential voters. And I feel like after 2004, that really collapsed a little bit, especially on the right. I think President Obama, former President Obama, he, you know, did a pretty good job at creating this idea of hope within the electorate. But again, I mean, still probably even collapsed a little bit in terms of what he was going to be able to accomplish in his presidency. And I think that basically, you know, that idea of pluralism basically has disintegrated now. And, you know, I think there's a lot of voters out there who basically voted for Biden because it wasn't Trump, right? And I think that there's a lot of Trump voters who voted for Trump because of, you know, something that he stands for is what they stand for, right? And so I don't think you get that kind of pluralism. That's the big difference is that I see it.
If you look at Bush Sr., if you look at, I mean, Clinton, especially as, like, you know, a Democrat, like, doesn't, you know, if you look at the Clinton years, he doesn't really, he feels very centrist, right?
Yeah,
like,
I agree.
It's super centrist. And so, right, maybe we should take a step back and kind of think about, like, what defines this neoliberal era? And then, you know, so we have, like, politics, they're fairly centered, and they're going to argue that kind of over time, political factions, or I guess factions within political parties, felt like, you know, the two candidates were giving kind of the same things, and so they didn't really have a voice. I don't know how much they don't really provide much evidence for that. We're just kind of like, we're arguing by anecdotes of, like, to support this, like, or not, like, by, like, people who were, you know, Jason was only 43 then, and I was only like 20 something, you know, whatever. But one thing they do mention that's important is, like, thinking about rises in inequality, and we're gonna have to keep kind of coming back to inequality as we go through the book. And there's this beautiful picture, we'll put up a link to it, of kind of, if you look at over time, if you look at labor productivity, so gains in labor productivity and gains in real wages over time, like, they track each other really well up until 1973. And there's this crazy looking divergence on a graph of, you know, labor productivity goes up and wages go up until 1973. And then, kind of based on the way things are measured, real wages become flat post 1973 while labor productivity is still increasing. And so the question is kind of like, well, you know, if labor is becoming more productive, generating more value, kind of where the wages are, like, where the returns
are. Why aren't they being compensated? Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, the argument is, like, that's going to capital, right? That's going to capital, the owners of capital instead of labor. And so they make some arguments that, like, based on kind of how you measure things, real household, like, median household wages or salaries haven't increased or increased much. And labor share of income has gone down too. Okay. So, like, more of that income is going to capital. I don't know how much we want to kind of dwell on this. I'm sort of the opinion, I'm more aligned with, like, Eric in the discussion here, where he's saying, like, look, measuring this stuff is super, super hard. Actually, Russ Roberts has, like, a really kind of convincing kind of short video. It's convincing to me, at least, on, like, some of the measurement issues that are involved. Like, if we're looking at things based on households, you know, that compositions of households have changed over time, and we have, like, more single households. And so because of that, like, if you just kind of, like, look at that, then if you look at, like, household income over time, like, that has remained relatively constant. But if you follow individuals individually over time, like, there have been big increases in kind of real wages, real salaries to these individuals. Now, like, you know, I mean, there's so many ways you can cut the data. You can find support for the other side that kind of these things have been stagnant. I do also like the argument that Eric makes about, like, look, like, products have changed and, like, people are better off because of that. So, like, you guys want to throw in some examples of, like, products that, like, the way things have changed where, like, even if real wages are the same, we're actually better off.
Go to Costco and get, like, a 100-pound bag of chicken for, like, $20.
There you go. Yeah.
I mean, computers, right? I mean, I think that's like one of the computers are just infinitely better than they were 30 years ago. And they're, I mean, again, if you adjust for, you know, inflation, I think a computer today is cheaper than it was, you know, when it was first introduced. And so yeah. Like you, GDP just does not, you know, account for that.
Smartphones are a great example. I think like, yeah. Reductions in prices to consumers, whether it's from Costco, you know, Walmart was kind of the historical example. And now Amazon's a great example of that. Like all, you know, whether it's prices going down for consumers or quality improving along certain dimensions. The thing that came to my head was like, well, Google's free, right? And that's like amazing. And that's not captured by these statistics. And then I was gonna say like Facebook is free and like social media is free. And like that makes us better off. And then I had to kind of, then I was in my head, I was kind of backtracking. It was like, is social media making us better off? That's not necessarily in line with like.
Is it free? I mean, that's the better question. But that's it for another day.
I would be really curious to hear what you guys have to say on that, though. I mean, are you both just going to say, it's too complicated? Or do you think you can at least come with a – because I do feel like that inequality between – I mean, like the Occupy movement was really big. Like that was – I was in high school.
Oh, and yeah, that, right.
You know, the takeaway, you know, the 1% has, you know, 30-40% of all – you know, resources. Would you guys say that is accurate, or are you still just going to say like it's too complicated? There is a lot of different things that have changed in the market, and
I think we need to make a distinction between like inequality and like standard of living. So I'm of the opinion that everyone's standard, not everyone. That's way too strong of a statement. On average, people's standards of living in the U.S. is higher now than it has been at any point in history, but also inequality is higher than at any given point in history. Like I believe both those things are true. Like we're more unequal society in terms of like wealth, but also that like, you know, we've never been more prosperous in terms of like material wealth, and that's not just to the 1%. That's like an average measure. Like on average, the average household, the average individual is better off than they ever have been in the U.S. Like, and that's not Trump like making America great again. That's just kind of like that's just been a trend. I don't want to downplay Trump.
Well, I really did try to out you as a fraud on that one, but if you come back, I gotta say.
So, all right. Now back to the Occupy movement. Like one thing that has always kind of puzzled me is like how much of this is like latent moral outrage about levels of inequality versus like a like swift, sudden response to the policies that were enacted after the financial crisis, where like, you know, investment banks got bailouts. These were like heavily publicized. And like, I don't know. I mean, I think like, Jason, what do you think about the word bailout?
Yeah, I don't like it. I don't think it's an accurate statement, right? I think if you actually look at some of the policies enacted, that banks and private companies weren't necessarily bailed out, that they had to put up collateral for the loans that they were given by the government, and they paid those loans back, right? And it was
the government bought equity and, you know,
right. That's exactly right. 100%. Right. So that I think if anything, you know, it was actually a precursor to the, lending facilities that we see being touted as some of the best, answers to what was happening during COVID, that the Federal Reserve rolled out. So I don't like that word bailout.
I'm gonna characterize your answer using a quote. That was a lifeless and largely self-serving technocratic answer,
which I disagree.
I actually agree with you, but like we also do need to recognize that we are both like technocrats, and like we can't. I mean, like look, a lot of these like financial institutions didn't take a haircut on a lot of this stuff, and like it, in the public perception, was terrible.
I agree. Right. So I think like, so people are like, well, where's my money? Why don't I get the same kind of bailout? Well, you know, the government it's very different, right? What am I putting up for collateral, right? Am I giving the government, you know, my house and they're going to give me, you know, $5,000 and then I'm going to pay that back? People want grants. They don't want, you know, loans. And that's what businesses got. That businesses got loans.
Yeah. At the same time, like there was a lot of bad behavior, and like one person went to jail.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, and yeah,
and the, you know, and there was all, you know, and like, you know, CEOs got all sorts of bonuses at a time when, like, you know, contractually, like you're not wrong, but like, gosh, it's just like the optics are just like terrible.
No, I agree with all of that. I just think I'm thinking of this more so like as a policy perspective, you know, like how do we do the same type of policy to individuals that we do to banks? I just don't think that there's any parallel. It's just so different. And so you're basically just talking about helicopter drops of money at that point, right? To give out to people. And
we're going to come back to that.
Yeah.
With like policy prescriptions. All right. Maybe. Okay. So they're going to give us these three eras. We're going to say, look, you know, we had this post-World War II ending in the 70s with stagflation and kind of a breakdown in monetary policy. And then late 70s to the financial crisis, great moderation, things look good. Very technocratic center. Maybe during that same time, different political groups or groups within political factions are like feeling disenfranchised, like they don't have somebody that's kind of speaking their language. All right, now post-financial crisis, now we're kind of in a new era. And then on page 54 through 55, they're going to talk about like the different explanations for this rise in populism. So if you look on 54 and 55, the second paragraph under Mark, he says, when you look at much of the academic literature on populism, it tends to fall into three genres. I'm not going to read all of these quotes, but the first could be called "It's All Culture." And the next paragraph it goes on to call, they kind of in quotes call it "It's All Economics." And the third genre is kind of lumped under something like geography and skills. Do either of you want to take like a hard stance on like where you attribute most of the rise in populism to, or do we kind of want to go through each one of them?
I don't know. I think my hard stance, if I was forced to say, is economics. It just is. It all boils down to economics. And, I think, you know, people, you know, if you're outraged that we're getting a bad deal from China, well, that's economics. If you're outraged at healthcare costs, well, that's economics, right? If you're outraged by people are taking my jobs, well, that's economics, right? And I think to me, it's all about the economics.
I feel like that's hard to argue with too, just because it, like the culture existed before the recession, you know, religion and like conservatism and liberalism. I mean, as far as political spectrums go, existed before the recession, but it wasn't until after the recession that it seemed like populist movements were really rising in the US and Europe, probably a lot of other places too.
Yeah. I don't disagree with any of that. I think like the one thing I would say about on the culture aspect is the thing that they mention in the book is kind of in that paragraph, they talk about perceptions of status loss amongst working class male populations. And like, you probably want to put like an extra adjective in there and say like working class white male population. Yeah. Like that's a real thing. And like, that's something like, I mean, it's just so visible right now with like, if you look at like, who stormed the Capitol and like who are the members of these Proud Boys and stuff like that, like whether this is like reality or stuff that's being amplified by the media, like I mean I just can't tell, but like gosh, you know, you just see this stuff and this stuff is like associated with like opioid use and like that, that's documented, right? Like these, like when they mentioned like Deaton's mentions deaths of despair, like drug overdoses and stuff like that. And I'm like, I don't know how much of that status loss or perceived status loss is the result of economics. You know, I've heard the kind of nice quote that culture follows the economics, and that would be an example, but I don't know, but like that, that is a real thing. And like, if we now have these echo chambers where, you know, we can kind of say like, oh, this is kind of crummy. And like, you know, there's this, all this wokeism and like all this stuff. And, you know, I feel, I'm feeling disenfranchised as like as a white male, you know, for reason X, Y, or Z, like that's a real thing. I mean, that, like, whether it's justified or not, it is a real thing. And like that to me, that feels partly cultural, right? Like status loss is like a real danger or like a real threat that people worry about.
I don't know. I don't feel like it's culture. To me, cultural means like I grow up in, you know, Minnesota, and because I'm a white guy, I like just, I'm like angry. That's, I don't think that's right. Right. I mean, your anger is motivated by some economic impact that has been, you know, imparted on you. It's not like I'm just, you know, I just go around the grocery store and it's just all angry white guys talking about like why we're all angry.
It's just, you don't hear that a lot?
I just bagged a deer.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm real angry.
Yeah.
No, but like, I have like, I can think of like buddies in South Carolina that like, who hear this rhetoric of like political correctness. And I'm thinking about like white male working class people that have like, they're good people that are like doing the right thing. And like, but you know, you hear this rhetoric of like, oh, you need to be like this, like language of wokeism where like, you need to be ashamed of your whiteness and you need to be like, you need to be repentant. And
like your privilege.
Yeah. And you know, and I can, you know, I can imagine that like, look, like if you're somebody who's been kind of doing the right thing and you know, a kind person, and maybe you got a bad draw and like you're a white male too, like, and you hear this rhetoric on top of that that's like, you know, like you need to be like repentant for like being a white male even after you got a bad draw, maybe, like that's got to be frustrating. And I think like that, I mean, I see it on my Facebook feed, and then like but you see it with like these, like, you know, these, what the what are these, the people that stormed the Capitol, what are they calling themselves? Are these like
QAnon shamans?
Oh yes, the QAnons and the
I don't know. I mean, I guess your point's well taken. It's hard for me to see beyond the economics, though. And you know, I guess as an economist, I'm always going to try and weave, you know, the economics back into whether it's geographical or skill-based differences or whether you think it's cultural, because I just feel so strongly that it's economic inequality that's just driving all of this, whether it's driving and perpetuating a specific culture and a belief, it's economic inequality that's doing that in some way. It's just so hard for me to see beyond that. I don't know. Change my view though.
Well, I agree with you. The geography and skills stuff seems completely tied with economics. I'm not sure kind of why that to me feels like a very subset of economics. Maybe I'm just missing something, kind of urban versus rural.
So what is your kind of takes on dialogue too? Cause we gotta start wrapping up this first episode.
Yeah. I don't know. They bring up a lot of good points, and as I'm reading this, economists generally don't write books. And the reason why we don't generally like journal articles and don't write books is because like books just give yourself too much room to like say things that just like aren't super tight, right? And like
that's true.
There's a lot of stuff in there that feels kind of loose and needs more, you know, tightening up.
It's so true. Yeah.
But the points are like even though the points are somewhat speculative at times, like the points are not necessarily wrong. And I think the authors do a fairly good job of like making a compelling narrative and doing it in kind of an easy to read way. I think the dialogue has pros and cons. Do you guys like the sort of the dialogue style?
I do. I'm not super concerned about exact statistics and, you know, all that stuff. I definitely like the dialogue style, just the two guys talking. Sometimes they agree, sometimes they disagree.
I do like that. No, I think that's right. I get lost a little bit in what they're trying to kind of explore, though. That's my only criticism.
Okay, cool. Well, one thing we didn't touch that was going to come back up that is a big deal too is like changes in demography.
Yeah,
they're gonna put in quote secular stagnation as like an explanation for why we have low interest rates right now, and low levels of inflation. We'll kind of come back to demographic issues as an explanation or a partial explanation for that as we go. Any final thoughts?
I'm angry.
Yes, that's right.
Your anger is legitimate.
When I saw that guy walking through the Capitol holding the podium wearing the Trump toboggan, yeah, like, smiling cheerfully, I wasn't angry at all. I guess I should have been.
Does it shock you to learn that he's from Florida?
No.
It was two guesses, Arizona or Florida.
And the story about the QAnon shaman like only eating organic food, like that's adorable. Yeah. It's really hard to be concerned about this.
These are real people, right? Like, this is the first time, you know, when you get these stories of these, you know, not like general mobs, but like individual people, like, it's easy to forget that these are real people who feel disenfranchised, who feel like they've been wronged by something. And this is exactly what the book is trying to tackle.
Yeah. Let's make one more note. They're like, what they did was treasonous.
Everyone yes, no, like, I agree. I don't.
Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah. All right, well, this is a really good start to the conversation. I can't wait to join you guys again, and we'll tackle, what is it, Dialogue 3 next for us?
Next up is Macro.
All right.
Can't wait to pick your guys' brains on that one.